Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Election officials are still counting ballots in a few races from this week's primaries. With me for an update and a look ahead to some of November's big legislative races is Jim Small, editor of the Arizona Capital Times. And Jim, as it stands, Christine Jones is holding a lead over Andy Biggs in the 5th Congressional District, and incumbent Helen Purcell overcame challenger Aaron Flannery's lead yesterday in the Maricopa County Recorder's primary. Does it seem those two are each ultimately headed to victory?
It does. Obviously there are still votes to be counted. My last count that I got from Maricopa County, at least, was a shade under 38,000 ballots are left overall. In the case of Helen Purcell, about 28,000 of those are Republican primary ballots. But the way that trend went yesterday, they counted something like, 35 or 50,000 ballots yesterday, and she essentially made up about 800 votes, maybe 900 votes. On Aaron Flannery. That trend likely will continue, which makes it exceedingly likely, I think, that she'll hang on to that seat. In terms of Congressional District 5, Christine Jones does have a slim lead over Andy Biggs. Right now it stands at 578 votes. That is fewer than it was a couple days ago. It was up over 800. However, mathematically, I really don't see a way for him to actually catch her.
There were a couple of legislative incumbents who were defeated on Tuesday. Did any of them come as a surprise?
The biggest surprise, without a doubt, was Jeff Dial, Republican representative from a district that covers Chandler and South Tempe in the Ahwatukee area. That was one that I don't think really most people in the political bubble saw happening. He lost fairly handily to a man named Frank Schmuck, and yes, that is his real name. And he was able to pull off an upset victory over Jeff Dial. And so now we'll see how that race shapes up in the general election. Democrats were cautiously optimistic about that race going against Jeff Dial. But I think with an open seat with a newcomer who was running to the right of Jeff Dial, I think Democrats are a little bit more bullish about that district than they were, maybe a week ago.
I have been reading, including in your publication, about Democrats' hope for possibly a split Senate, 15 Democrats, 15 Republicans, using this district as one of the examples of maybe a pickup for them. How realistic do you think that is?
It's a slim chance. No doubt. It's definitely not a good chance that it's going to happen. Right now, the Senate sits at 18-12. Democrats are guaranteed to pick up one of those seats. Carlisle Begay, a Democrat turned Republican, he didn't run for re-election. Democrats are going to win that seat, so they'll knock down the Republican majority to at least 17. There are four seats, basically, though, that they're targeting as potential pickups. I think best case scenario is going to be that they're able to get it back to 15-15 split. There's the Jeff Dial district in the Chandler Ahwatukee area. There is Barbara McGuire, the incumbent Democrat, against Frank Pratt. Representative Frank Pratt is running against her in a Pinal County district. Sylvia Allen from northeastern Arizona, Republican, is being challenged by Nikki Bagley, a Democrat, former mayor of Jerome. That one is probably an uphill climb for the Democrats, probably a little bit too much. And then I think the marquee race is really going to be kind of a north-central Phoenix district. It's Representative Kate Brophy McGee, the Republican, and Democrat Eric Meyer are both running for an open Senate seat. Both of them have served a number of terms in the House. They're both centrist Republican and centrist Democrat for a district that has, for a long time, really elected people from the middle.
One of the other interesting primary races that won't affect the balance of power is two Republicans, but in Mojave County, State Representative Sonny Borelli was going up against former State Senator Ron Gould, and this race had gotten pretty nasty as far as sort of the dialogue or lack thereof between the two of them. Borelli won that primary. Policy-wise, do you think that will make much of a difference?
It will, in the sense, certainly not to imply that Sonny Borelli is not conservative, because he is. Ron Gould, though, was much more of an ideologue. Sonny Borelli is much more of a team player, I think, is the way he likes to characterize it. He said, "I understand that there are times where you have to basically subjugate your own personal desires and your own, maybe even your own personal ideology for the greater good in order to get things accomplished." And he said Ron Gould was never able to do that and never even interested in doing anything like that. And that was one of the arguments that he made to voters as to why he should be there instead of Ron Gould.
Jim Small is editor of the Arizona Capital Times. Jim, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump's harsh words about Mexico and some Mexican Americans have many thinking he'll receive even less support from Latinos in November than his predecessors like Mitt Romney and John McCain. A poll released today by Latino Decisions and America's Voice moves that speculation into something more concrete. The survey of 3,729 Latino-registered voters in the U.S. was conducted between August 19th and 30th before Trump's Wednesday visit to Mexico. Sylvia Manzano, a principal with Latino Decisions, is with me to discuss the survey results. Sylvia, immigration and deportation were at or near the top of the list that the Latino voters you polled thought Congress should address. How do you interpret that?
We ask that question in two ways. We ask it in, you know, the self-reference to your own community and your own ethnic group. And that's where, you know, we are not surprised when immigration is one or two. But then we do the follow-up question where we don't give the ethnic cue and just say, what do you think is the most important issue facing the country? And immigration usually ranks third when we do that, sometimes second. But if we don't give that ethnic cue, we usually see the economy. Sometimes immigration will bubble up to second or first on the generic question if there's something going on that's relevant, that makes it a national story. In this context, you know, you have a presidential election that's really being defined by immigration politics and rhetoric. And so I think for that reason, we see it rank highly context that we ask the question.
The feelings about President Obama, at least from what I've heard in the past, had seemed to have been a little bit mixed, positive in some ways as far as DAPA and DACA, but then others had also labeled him deporter in chief. Did you see that split at all in this particular poll?
No, he has a 75% favorable rating and a net of 52. He did have a bad spell when the deportations were hitting a peak, and we've seen his favorability with Latinos kind of ebb and flow throughout his presidency. After his attempts at the second round of executive actions on DAPA and expanded DACA, his approval ratings went back up well over the 60% mark, and they've stayed there.
How much of an evolution have you seen in the polling that you've done over the course of 2016 as it became clear that Donald Trump was a Republican nominee?
Those sentiments are solidifying, that this is a pretty easy contrast for voters to make, especially when voters in the Hispanic community feel like they're being talked about or in some cases being yelled about and scapegoated in some really, really ugly ways. For that reason, I think that the view about sort of who's on your side at a very fundamental level, just showing basic respect, not even getting to a policy issue, but just treating you and people like you with respect, there's just a very different line of demarcation than we've seen in prior years in terms of how people view the Republican Party broadly, and Donald Trump in particular.
This really stood out to me with the question, thinking about the upcoming 2016 presidential election, do you feel it is more important you vote in this election compared to the last one in 2012? And 76% said 2016 was more important. What did you make of that? What are some of the factors? Is there something besides Trump that is really driving those numbers?
Well, among the 76% who said that this contest was more important, 51% said the reason it was more important was because it was important to stop Donald Trump or to stop his campaign that is being hurtful or racist towards Hispanics, Muslims, Blacks. The umbrella of Stop Trump captured 51% of those who said this contest is more important. Another 23% said the reason this contest was more important was because it was important to elect Hillary Clinton. And then you had another 15% who said it was important because they wanted to support Trump and stop Clinton. But their margins are, you know, obviously much smaller.
Now, the survey was taken, of course, before Trump's meeting with President Enrique Peña Nieto on Wednesday. Would you mind speculating at all? Do you think that that meeting and then the follow-up speech in Phoenix, which to some was contradictory to the meeting, would affect how some of the folks you polled would have felt? Would they have been even more strongly against Trump, or could it have spun it some other way?
Well, as a pollster, I have no data on the future. But we do have a poll in the field right now to ask that very question. I expect that we will see negative reaction to the Phoenix speech. The response to the trip to Mexico City will be neutral, that it doesn't help or hurt, that people kind of shrug their shoulders and say, eh.
Sylvia Manzano is a principal with Latino Decisions. We've been talking about a new poll on what Latinos think of the presidential race. Yesterday on the show, we told you about the serious shortage of doctors that our state is facing. Right now, we need more than 400 primary care physicians in Arizona to fill the state's needs and more than 200 psychiatrists. The show's Lauren Gilger has been digging into this issue and joins us now. And Lauren, what areas are most in need?
Geographically, it's most of the state that's in what's called a health professional shortage area. But it's especially tough to find doctors to work in rural areas like tribal lands and in some urban areas as well. And like you pointed out, there are also shortages in certain fields, especially primary care physicians and psychiatrists.
So what's the state doing to try to attract physicians to fill the gaps?
Right. So I sat down with Anna Rossetti, the workforce section manager with the Arizona Department of Health Services. She oversees several programs that are trying to bring in doctors to these areas and into these fields.
Even though there's enough physicians in an area, there may not be enough physicians that are serving the underserved or the low-income population.
The health department administers a tuition reimbursement program for doctors and advanced practice providers like nurse practitioners and mental health providers. So if a doctor commits to working for 2 years in an underserved area, they can get up to $65,000 of their student loans paid. And they also oversee a visa program for foreign doctors who are willing to work for at least 3 years in one of those areas in need. So I went to St. Joseph's Hospital in Central Phoenix to meet one of those doctors. He's from Syria, and he's working here helping underserved people in the valley.
What's the name here?
Dr. Majd Al-Farjad is sitting at a computer in a tiny office near the emergency department at St. Joseph's Hospital in Central Phoenix.
Yeah, we'll go see the last one, which is in 506. Okay.
Putting in an order for his last patient of the day.
All right, we can go see him.
He's an internal medicine physician here, essentially a general practitioner for patients who come to the emergency room and need to be admitted for further care.
Hello. Yep. How are you?
Good. Dr. Al-Farjad here, the medical doctor. I'm good.
They told me you came here with some left leg infection.
Yep.
All right. How did this happen?
In a car accident.
Internal medicine physicians are primary care providers that we don't have enough of in Arizona.
You deal with everything.
And St. Joseph's in Central Phoenix is an underserved area of the state where there aren't enough doctors to serve the number of people in need.
A lot of uninsured people. We get a lot of people from the shelter, from CAS, from Circle of the City, versus somebody who's practicing like in Scottsdale. It's a completely different population.
And that's why Al-Farjad is here. He's one of 30 physicians a year in the state who are granted what's called a J-1 visa waiver. They're foreign doctors who qualify for this federal program and agree to work in an area designated as a health professional shortage area or a medically underserved area for at least 3 years. And for Al-Farjad, it's opened some important doors.
I mean, medicine is definitely the best in the states, you know, in terms of all the new research, the training is the best. I wouldn't have the same opportunity should I stay in Syria.
The visa is part of the National Interest Waiver Programs, and when a doctor has completed their commitment, they can either go back to their home country for 2 years or get a sponsoring employer to get them a work authorization permit.
How bad is the pain if you want to rate it from 0 to 10?
It's probably about 4 or 5.
Al-Farjad has worked in Phoenix for 3 years now. In just a few weeks, he'll be able to apply for his green card. But he says the whole time, he's never felt all that foreign here.
I think people overall, they're used to foreign doctors. If you're good, you prove that you're good. It doesn't matter where you're from.
And with a war raging in Syria, he says he doesn't have much of a home to go back to.
It's going to be always my country, but it's unfortunate now. That's probably, on my generation, it's not going to get better. This is probably going to be my home.
Al-Farjad is planning to do a fellowship next, hopefully in Tucson. And he says he feels like he's been able to make a real difference here in his adopted country.
It is rewarding.
Last month, the family came in with their father, who was suffering from dementia.
We can't do a lot in terms of treating the disease itself, but you can do a lot about educating the family, letting them know what's the prognosis, how this disease is going to progress.
Often, nobody's ever taken the time to explain it to them, he says. So he did.
It doesn't have to be a big thing. You know, I'm not a surgeon. I don't do like big surgeries, but it's simple things sometimes. Yeah.
For the show, I'm Lauren Gilger.
Recent years have not been kind to for-profit colleges, including the University of Phoenix and ITT Technical Institute. Lawsuits are pending, challenging how the schools have admitted students and some of their financial practices. In a new piece for Democracy Journal, Ben Miller of the Center for American Progress wrote about where for-profits have been and where they need to go to survive into the future. Ben, how did for-profits get to this struggling stage?
During the recession, these schools added lots and lots of people because there were a large number of Americans who were out of work, and so these schools basically gobbled up as many students as they could, which made them very attractive to their stock price. But as the economy got better, essentially a lot of the same people who may have been thinking about going to college were able to find a job. And so they decided to stop enrolling at these schools, bringing their enrollment down, which sort of really turned the investors in their stocks against them because they weren't growing as fast anymore. The other thing is that as these schools got so big, they had to keep on achieving impressive growth rates quarter after quarter to keep on showing to Wall Street they were a good investment. And the problem these schools ran into was basically at some point, they couldn't really find a lot more recruits who were going to succeed and be good at the school. And so they had to turn to extremely aggressive recruiting practices to try and get people to come in the door. They had to mislead people about the value of the education, things of that nature, all of which attracted a lot of legal scrutiny.
When we think about moving forward then, do they need to change not just the types of people in charge, but also be willing to completely change their education model? And does that put them then in a different stratosphere? Does that take away anything special from what they've been offering, at least have advertised they've been offering?
So I don't think so. I mean, I think it is clear the current business model used by a lot of for-profit companies really doesn't work. But actually, I think the business model and the operation and the style they have to go back to is really one that a lot of them had sort of before they were enticed by Wall Street and tried to get as big as possible. You know, I think that it's clear there is a niche for sort of a certain type of learner that these schools can do pretty well with, but that they shouldn't really be pursuing the size and scale and scope that they were doing. You know, first, I think they really have to refocus on a certain type of learner, and that is an adult who has stable employment, stable transportation, and sort of is in a place in their life where they're ready to succeed in college. You know, that doesn't mean going down the route of, say, a typical university and requiring SAT scores or high grades or anything like that, but just asking the basic question of, you know, given that there's only 24 hours in a day, does this person have enough time in their life to commit to college in the way they need to succeed? The second thing they probably have to do is abandon a lot of the cheap, attractive certificates that a lot of them use to grow as big as possible. This is, I think, the place where they also really went awry was, and Phoenix is a great example of this, they had this model that sort of worked with adult learners at the bachelor's or master's degree level, and they started offering a lot more associate degrees and certificates. Those are the places where the outcomes were just really abysmal because there wasn't necessarily a workforce demand. They sort of invented these credentials. You'll even hear some of the schools joke that when CSI was really popular on CBS, they would start doing things like offering criminal forensics certificates or associate degrees to try and attract people. There's not enough of those jobs, and there's no return for it.
And Ben, finally, in your piece, you say the for-profit college sector has most likely yet to hit bottom. What would it take for them to hit bottom? And then do they have to hit bottom to sort of implement some of these ideas you have?
For the sector's image to recover, the sort of worst of the worst need to be recognized as no longer a threat to students and taxpayers. And, you know, we're already seeing that. You know, a great example of that is ITT Technical Institute is in very dire straits right now and, in fact, could very well shut down sometime around Labor Day weekend. Actually, Phoenix is probably the most interesting of the cases because it's in the process of potentially undergoing a sale to private investors that would take it off the stock market. They're claiming they're going to think through the business model again, et cetera. And, you know, whether or not Phoenix is able to really make the same pivot that those who have been more thoughtful in the sector have made will be an interesting case to see.
Ben Miller is the Senior Director for Post-Secondary Education at the Center for American Progress. We've been talking about his piece for Democracy Journal called Back to the Future at For-Profit Colleges. Ben, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The League of Arizona Cities and Towns has a new president. Chandler Mayor J. Tibbetts-Traney has taken the helm for a two-year term, and he joins me to talk about it. Mayor Tibbetts-Traney, do you have any specific goals for this post?
You know, the goals are more generic and general and versus we want to achieve this benchmark by this date and that benchmark by this other day. You know, the goals are to represent that organization and hopefully to bring more recognition to that organization.
Do you find that the cities and towns across the valley and across the state are generally on the same page as far as what they'd like to see have happen?
I think generally we are. There's always specific nuances with any city or town, but in terms of what we at the league try to do, because it's a voluntary membership, but all 91 of our cities and towns in the state are members, which tells you for something. But obviously a lot of our stuff, the smaller cities get a lot of services from the league that maybe those services aren't needed by bigger cities like Chandler or Phoenix or Tucson and what have you. But also, I think more importantly, though, we're our unified voice at the legislature when it comes to representing cities' interest and working with the legislature or the governor's office or any of the agencies.
I'm glad you brought up the legislature, and I'm interested in your perspective on this because you have been a mayor, you have been a member of the state legislature, you served in the state Senate for many years.
I did.
Every year, it seems like there are some bills that state lawmakers are looking at and sometimes pass that cities don't like. This past year, though, it seemed particularly intense with the new law that allows lawmakers and the AG to investigate cities if they pass ordinances that conflict with state laws. So I'm curious, first off, to sort of get your sense of what is the current temperature of the relationship between the state and its cities.
Well, obviously, this last session was a challenging session for all of the cities and towns, and particularly with Senate Bill 1487. That became a real focal point of the session for us and kind of was reflective of how the session went when that was seen as kind of the worst of the worst. So, there's always challenges that we as cities and towns need to do. I'm hoping that I can bridge some of those gaps. I don't think that they'll ever be totally bridged because there, for whatever reason, historically has been with the legislature. And even so, when I was down there, there are few legislators that want to maybe micromanage what cities and towns do. So I think my job is to try and do a better job of communicating with the legislature and the governor's office and to hopefully maybe head off some stuff before it gets too bad. That will be a high priority that we will work on.
I'm curious about your perspective on how you balance the needs of your city, of Chandler, with sort of this idea of regionalism with all the cities in the valley and the idea that maybe if a business goes to Gilbert, for example, Chandler could benefit, although I'm sure you'd much rather it end up in Chandler instead.
Yeah, you know, the nice thing is, and we're really fortunate, and sometimes we need to be thankful that we live in a valley and a dynamic area, but a lot of times, we'll compete with our other valley cities or our other East Valley cities for an economic development client or project. And we would like to get those, but we don't. But there is a benefit to all of the cities when a big company locates, and also other companies that will say, hey, the East Valley's pretty good or Maricopa County's good. We're going to go locate. So, although you are competitors, we do all benefit. It's not like things are so sparse that we get one new company locating here every 5 years. I think we've moved past the turf wars maybe of 20 years ago where, cities maybe competed and then it didn't all heal up after the competition.
Chandler Mayor J. Tibbs-Schrainey is the new president of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. Mayor Tibbs-Schrainey, thanks.
Thank you very much, Mark. I'll talk to you later.
Arizona State kicks off their 2016 football season tomorrow night at the newly renovated Sun Devil Stadium in Tempe. The $268 million renovation project started in 2014 and has seen the stadium undergo significant changes.
Over the past several months, the upper north concourse was removed to begin construction on a new athletic facility. There will be new training areas and coaches' offices.
If you've been to the stadium, you've probably noticed that early September games can get pretty steamy. Maggie Emmons from Sun Devil Athletics says the entire West Concourse was also demolished and rebuilt to offer the space a little room to breathe.
We raised the ceilings to 20 feet from 8 feet, so you can really feel the increased airflow. That's going to help keep fans a little bit cooler on game days.
They also took out a lot of seating. The capacity has gone from more than 70,000 to just more than 56,000.
They're not quite done. ASU is still planning to demolish and rebuild the East Concourse with similar airflow and seating improvements. They're also putting in a new scoreboard.
It's going to be over 100 feet wide, and it's going to be set up in the north end zone, and it's going to be kind of the main focal point and the main finishing touch that brings everything together.
Emmons says the price tag sits at $268 million.
Which comes from private donations and university bonds. So no taxpayer dollars and no tuition dollars were used.
ASU is planning for final construction to end prior to the start of the 2017 season. Until then, Sun Devil football is back on the gridiron for another season tomorrow.
Are we losing the Grand Canyon? It's a straightforward yet complicated question, and it's the headline of an article in the September issue of National Geographic magazine. In it, National Geographic writer Kevin Fedarko and photographer Pete McBride take a 650-mile hike through the canyon and consider what proposed development projects in and around it would mean for one of the country's most iconic landscapes. Kevin and Pete join me. And Pete, let me start with you. What was the inspiration behind your trek?
I think the goal of our project, we don't want to make it sound like people have to hike 700 miles to experience or enjoy Grand Canyon. I think the goal is to raise awareness of the park and how some people think it's the most protected landscape in the world, but in fact its borders are becoming very, very challenged. And it's not about restricting access, it's about the right kind of access and use and the quality of experience so we can all learn from this remarkable landscape that is unique to this planet, really, and that we're not loving it to death.
Kevin, the story is about the possibility of, as the title implies, losing the Grand Canyon. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it turns out that the Grand Canyon, which is one of the best known of all of our national parks, it's a place that's instantly recognizable to almost every citizen of this country. It's a place that so many of us assume to be sacrosanct and inviolable. But in fact, it turns out that the canyon is currently surrounded by a host of development threats from literally every point of the compass. And these threats separately and together threaten to inflict irreparable harm and do tremendous damage to the integrity of this incredibly iconic national park.
Yeah, the article outlines some of the proposals. There are retail developments. There's a tramway proposal. Why is it that folks, especially some of the American Indian tribes who have reservations as part of the park, why shouldn't they be able to do some of these projects that might actually really help their residents?
Well, it's an excellent question that you ask, and I think the shorter answer is they should. I mean, one of the inconvenient truths that lies at the heart of the story of our national parks that so many of us are not aware of is that these places, which we decided as a nation to set aside and preserve for future generations of Americans, so many of them, including the Grand Canyon, were occupied by Native American tribes. And these tribes, as the National Park Service was created, as the parks were developed, these tribes were disenfranchised, they were kicked out, and they were literally marginalized. These are tribes that many of them have enormous economic challenges that they're confronting, and they're asking themselves, why shouldn't we capitalize literally as well as figuratively on our proximity to this national treasure? I think the thing, however, to insert is that many of these projects are ideas that are being brought to these tribes by outsiders. And there are people within each of these tribes who are arguing that the developments are not harmonious with and are indeed antithetical to the cultural traditions and the relationship with the land that these tribes have cultivated for centuries.
Would you draw a distinction then between some of those projects that have been brought to the tribes and ideas that maybe originated within the tribes? Might you be a little more sympathetic to an idea that, for example, you know, Navajo council members had come up with for themselves to do something in the park itself?
Absolutely. And I think the Navajo tribe offers a tremendous example. Anyone who goes to Canyon de Chelly will see what it's like to have an experience staying in a small modest hotel that is run entirely by Navajo, moving out across the land with Navajo guides. The money that you spend if you go up to Canyon de Chelly stays within the Navajo Nation, stays within the communities that are there.
Pete, in your mind, how do you balance the need or maybe the wish to get people to the canyon, make it accessible to people, but also protect it and not turn it into, as one tribal member called it, Disneyland?
Well, that's the great question. And I think the park was established almost 100 years ago. Teddy Roosevelt said, leave it as it is. And today, of course, we want to find varying ways to visit it and understand it. But I think we already can see it in multiple different ways. You can go to the rim. There's handicap access to the rim. You can ride a burro down inside the canyon. You can do overflights. So I think the ability to see it right now exists, and the challenge we face is if we want to put handrails and make the amenities even more accessible, could potentially change this park in ways that will not line up with that original statement of leave it as it is.
Development is such a prevalent part of society, especially in Arizona, where there's been talk for years about how the area between Phoenix and Tucson, for example, will eventually just become one big metro area. Do you think that some of these projects can be stopped? I mean, do you think it's inevitable that there will eventually be a tramway to the bottom of the canyon, for example?
I think the future of the park really ultimately depends on us, the public. We are the ultimate stewards. It's our park at the end of the day. So it's the public's decision on how we want to see these wild places.
You mentioned the protected landscapes, and I would imagine that some, if not all, of these proposed development projects would have some kind of impact on the environment, the ecosystems, and potentially some of those landscapes within the park and within the canyon itself, right?
I believe so. And I think one of the greatest challenges around all of it is water. Water is one of the most limiting factors within the park. The water table and these natural springs that exist create a biosphere and a uniqueness that exists in some areas that only exist in Grand Canyon on the planet.
Kevin, in your mind, relative to all these development projects, what is the best case scenario for the canyon and the park, and what is the worst case scenario in your mind?
The worst case scenario in my mind is that these projects are allowed to continue in a manner that is unrestricted, and that these projects will, as they grow and burgeon, accelerate and reinforce one another to the point where you do not simply have a series of discrete developments that are occurring at isolated points along the east, south, north, and west rims of the Grand Canyon. What you have instead is a ring of helicopters and infrastructure and roads and tourists whose numbers and whose impacts are fundamentally inappropriate and have a destructive impact on the land itself. I think the best case scenario is that Americans who recognize that this really is the crown jewel of our national park system learn about what's happening and are outraged to the point that they are willing to step up and express their concern. And the other thing that I think is incredibly important, perhaps this is the most important element of all, I think that the best case scenario involves a recognition among all players that the people who were disenfranchised and marginalized from this landscape, these 11 tribes, that their voices are included in a discussion about how to move forward in a manner that is appropriate and preserves this landscape for future generations.
Kevin Fedarko is a writer for National Geographic. We also heard from photographer Pete McBride. Their article, Losing the Grand Canyon, is from the September issue of National Geographic magazine. We'll post a link to it on theshow.kjzz.org. There are many ways desert dwellers might try to conserve water, taking shorter showers, fixing leaky plumbing, or, in my case, procrastinating laundry day.
Well, the city of Scottsdale is offering an incentive to residents who completely remove a major source of water, their pool.
Pools use a lot of water. It is very, very hot here in the desert, and when we have days like the last couple of days that are so hot and so dry, water evaporates very quickly.
That's Nicole Sherbert with the City of Scottsdale's Water Department. She says as an incentive to residents to just get rid of that water, the city will give 50 cents per square foot of pool or spa that's removed.
The city's been giving rebates for turf removal since the 90s, and Sherbert says in the past 10 years, They've removed 1.7 million square feet of turf in Scottsdale.
But the question remains whether removing your pool is worth it. It's a process that can cost upwards of $10,000, not to mention cost of landscaping afterward.
The city is offering up to $1,500 for pool removals, but so far there haven't been any takers. Sherbert says they haven't received any applications yet since the program launched 2 months ago, but the idea isn't to remove all pools in the area.
If you find that you are using your pool often, then absolutely, we think pools are a great way to cool off in the summer here in Scottsdale. But for those families who really find that they aren't using their pool anymore, or that it is in need of very expensive repairs that you're just not sure are worth investing in, this rebate program is a great way to incentivize people to look at different options for that.
Warren Tenney is with the Arizona Municipal Water Users Association. That's a nonprofit focused on water issues in the state. He says Scottsdale is the first Arizona city to try a pool removal rebate. It's a bit of an experiment, but he says it's the right time to try it.
In the Phoenix area, pools are very popular, but there's starting to be a trend where a number of folks are recognizing that there is a lot of maintenance involved with them.
He says the number of new homes being built with pools has also taken a dip.
But if you're not wanting to dive into the pool removal process, he says keeping up with routine maintenance and covering your pool in the winter is the best way to conserve water and evaporate a little of your water bill, too.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.